And one of the reasons I'm loud is once a month we go to Stony Brook and Barbara sings and I preach and I don't have a mic. And it's Stony Brook assisted living. Practically everyone there is either hard of hearing or almost deaf. But they hear me. If nothing else, they feel this vibration, you know. I was holding it together pretty good emotionally. My mother died about 20 years ago, and often on Mother's Day is kind of a hard day for me. She was my age. She was 65. I'll be 65 in August. She had just turned 65. And I can remember taking my kids when they were Rebecca and Daniel's age, except there was four of them, to buy a Mother's Day card 3 years after she died, and I started crying. And I don't cry that much, you know, but it just kind of hit me. So I know that this whole thing about mothers is a big deal. And to be honest with you, I'm kind of a iconoclast or rebel or something. My first thought is I'm not going to do a Mother's Day message because, you know, that's what everybody expects, and I don't like doing what everybody expects. But then I thought some more about it, and I thought that I will do a Mother's Day theme, but I want to remind you for something first, that some of you, hopefully most of you knew your mother. Some of you may not have for various reasons, okay? Hopefully you had someone who was a mother figure in your life that you turned to. And then, sadly enough, sometimes even that's not the case, okay? Some of you are mothers, and most of you are not. But all of you love somebody and care about somebody and have wanted the best for somebody. And that is something that, so anyone who is a brother or a sister or a father or a mother or even, I don't know, some guy who lives on an island but once had someone that he cared about can benefit from what I've got to say. But I will talk about first a little bit about my mother, just a little bit, and then a whole lot about Sarai. And Sarai was Abram's wife. She got renamed. More on that later. And after I finish talking about that, I'll talk a little more about us in general. So the first thing about Mother's Day I would say is that I believe the most important thing for any kind of day like this is it's a time to remember what was good. Of course, if some bad things happen, they're going to come up. You're going to remember them. But it's a time to celebrate what's good in your mother. So I was thinking about my mother, and really, I was very fortunate. My mother and my father stayed together. They didn't get divorced, even though they had me. it must have been tempting for both of them. They loved each other, and she always showed that she loved me very much. And it started when I was a real little boy. There's so many stories, you know, that I can think of. But the other one of the things I'll tell you is my dad didn't like the outdoors. He didn't even like picnics, you know. He'd sit there and smoke impatiently waiting to get out of there. But my mother loved the outdoors, and she loved to fish. She taught me how to fish starting when I was about 6 or 7 years old. And she took me fishing all the time. My dad traveled more than TR, believe it or not. He traveled at least 40 weeks a year. He was a certified public accountant. He went around auditing all the Goodyear stores in Louisiana and Mississippi. So the only time he was in town is if he was auditing a store that happened to be within driving distance easy driving distance of our home. Otherwise, he was gone all week. so my mother meant an awful lot to me. I mean, she was the one that was always there. She taught me to fish. She was different from a lot of moms. I remember when I was a little kid, I got a lizard. There are a lot of lizards and reptiles down in Louisiana where I grew up. And for any other mom, you could go up and scare them. You know, so I went up to my mom and said, "Hey, Mom, I got something I want to show you." You know, She goes, "Oh, isn't he cute?" And she picks him up and, you know. Like, oh, man. She was tough. She was tough. We had several hurricanes in New Orleans. One of them, my dad was on one of his trips, as always. And I think it came on kind of unexpectedly, a little stronger than they expected, so he hadn't come home for it. And when the wind blows really fast outside, believe it or not, I want to go into this mechanical engineering lesson. But anyway, the windows blow out. They don't blow in. They blow out. And the window in my two brothers' bedroom, blew out. Boom! You know, and then all the rain's coming in and everything. And she went out into the hurricane with a hammer and nails and a blanket and nailed a blanket across that window to stop the wind and the rain from coming in. That's all she had to work with, you know. Another time, when I was a little bit older, I went to go out of our front door, and there's one step down, and there's a rattlesnake coiled up. There's a lot of snakes down there. And I was, whoa, you know. And I wasn't going to do anything about it. I was just a little kid. She was afraid that someone would come visit and step on this snake and get bit, you know, or that one of us would forget and go out the front door. And she went looking for the shovel, but I had left it somewhere. So all she had was a butcher knife with the blade broken off, so the blade was only about that long. And she got down on her knee, and she waited, and she boom, took its head off with the butcher knife. You know, she's 5'2", and weighed 97 pounds. You know, we did not mess with her. Even if she didn't have a butcher knife. I mean, I was the smallest of my two brothers. My two brothers were both bigger than me. I was the oldest, but they all grew more than I did. So, what's that? They took all the food. It was, they weren't a lot bigger. My dad was as big as all of us. So it was like, when we got on an elevator, I used to say it was a half a ton of schnockies got on the elevator. And that wasn't even counting my mom, you know. So, but you know, your mother is not that person on Focus on the Family magazine. She's not that person on the card. I mean, the cards and the magazine celebrate the things that are good. And so the mom that's smiling and serving the meal or, you know, holding the hurt person or something, that's real. Those things are real, but it's not the whole story, right? My mom, one reason she was so thin when she was younger is she was extremely anxious. And she was also, I didn't realize it until later in life, that she suffered from severe depression. And the reason I say that is we never even used those words, anxiety and depression, in those days. The only reason I know she was anxious is she had all kinds of tummy troubles, which I inherited. And then she slept all day. She would, and you know, I had two brothers, like I said. One was 2 years younger than me, and one was 1 year younger than me. And they were a lot like me, so if you can imagine. And this is the mellow me. So I would have slept all day if I was her, you know. But she was depressed. She would sleep. I remember one time we were building a fort. We always built forts. But we were building a fort down at the end of the block. And in the process, decided it would be cool to have a fire in the fort. And the fort caught fire and set fire to the grass all around the fort and the weeds and so on. And I knew I had to get somebody, so we ran down and I got the neighbor lady. And that was because I didn't want to wake my mom up. I knew, you know, she was always so groggy in the afternoon and everything. And the neighbor lady came and got a hose and put the fire out. I didn't hold that against my mom. But as I look back, I realized, you know, my mother is like the world. There's beautiful things and there's tragic things, you know. And they coexist in that one person. And that's the thing that's true for each one of you as well. There are these beautiful things and these tragic things. And God is working on us to create more and more of the beautiful things. And he doesn't take away the tragedy, but he redeems it and uses it to turn to good, to make even better things happen for us. So the thing that we can take a lot of comfort in is that even those tragic difficult things that we may remember about our mothers or our fathers or the people who took their place is that all of that has been used in your life to work to good. So when we talk about a biblical model of motherhood, you know, a lot of times people say the biblical model of motherhood, they're thinking of something like the last chapter or two of Proverbs, where it talks about the wife of noble virtue or whatever, and it tells about all the good things that she does. It's like all of Proverbs. It just tells you all the good stuff to do, right? And and if you're a human being and you read that, you go, oh, I hate that person. She's one of those people who does everything right, you know? But it's just a reminder of here are good things to do, and because we're under the new covenant, it is not a list of laws of you must do these good things in order to be loved. You're loved whether you do any of them or not, as long as you turn to God and open yourself to His love. So a biblical mother is a real person. The one I want to use is Sarai. I say Sarai. She was renamed Sarah by God later. But she and Abram moved from Iraq, basically, but Ur, yeah. And then they moved over to another spot, and then Abram's father died. And then they moved down to where Israel is now. And she went with him, and they got to be, 75 years old or so on, and had no children. And pretty much given up on the idea that they could have children. People lived longer then. They both lived into their hundreds, but still, by the time you were 75 or so, and your childbearing years were over. And God spoke to Abraham and told him, you're going to have a son, and he will turn into a whole nation of people. And he did. His son was Isaac. Isaac had Jacob. Jacob had 12 sons, their names are the 12 tribes of Israel. I know I haven't memorized them all. I know most of them. And those 12 tribes gradually turned into millions of people. Story about Sarai, by the way, is in Genesis. It's in the teens. And I just decided, I'm not telling you guys all this chapter and verse stuff. Read it! By the way, if you can't read well, listen to it. And on the internet, I was trying to figure out how you pronounce Sarai, because it's Sarai. And I realized on Bible Gateway, BibleGateway.com, you can look up any chapter or verse in any translation you want, and you can push a little speaker dealy, a picture of a speaker, and it'll read it to you. In this really good voice, you know. So, and interestingly enough, some of the chapters that I was looking to see how long it took this announcer guy in this nice, steady, measured voice to read a chapter, and it ranged between 2.5 to 5 minutes per chapter. So you can, all the chapters that I'm talking about here, and there's several of them involved back around 15 through 20 in Genesis, you know, in a time it takes you to watch World's Funniest Videos or something like that, you can hear someone read it really well. And I didn't want to read it all today, so I'm going to tell you the story bit by bit. Abraham tells God, you're going to have a son, and Abram how's that going to happen? I'm really old, and Sarah's old, and he says, it's going to happen. But nonetheless, he and Abram and Sarai get tired of waiting. They wait about 10 years, as I do the math. And finally, Sarai says, you know, God must have had something else in mind, so why don't you take my servant Hagar, have sex with her. So this is an early instance of surrogate motherhood, right? Have sex with her, have a child through her, and that will be our child, and he will be our heir. So Abraham says, all right, and he does it, and Ishmael is born. But before he's even born, Hagar gets pregnant, and she's pretty happy. I mean, this is pretty cool. You're the servant, and you're bearing the big guy's baby, right? And apparently she's kind of like, look, I'm the one that's pregnant, and Sarah, you know, sorry, but I'm the one that gets to have the baby. I don't even know if she really acted that way, but that's the way Sarai saw it. She saw it as, this woman's putting me down. Kick her out. So it's her idea to get her pregnant. And then she tells Abram, get rid of her. And so he kicks her out. He kicks her out into the desert. And God comes to Hagar and says, that's going to be all right. You are going to have a child, and he'll be the father of the nations, but he's not going to be the father of all these, of the Jewish nation. They didn't say that, but the father of the Jewish nation. And she comes back, and Sarah takes her in. God reaffirms to Abram and Sarai that they are going to have a son, and it is going to be his flesh. In other words, his genetics and so on. His seed, I guess they'd say in the old days. Abraham is 99 years old, and Abram and Sarai is 90 years old when he's telling them this. And Abram laughs. He's just like, really? How could that even happen? Well, he's speaking to God. Sarai wasn't even, I skipped a part. Why was he talking to this time? God had spoken to him clearly in visions and so on previously. This time God shows up in person. There's God and two other guys. And don't ask me, I don't know how it is that God in those days showed up in person. It was before Jesus Christ. There's a thing called a Christophany. You can look it up. There's just an idea of God taking human form. And there are several instances of it in the Old Testament. And this is one of those instances where God took human form. Sometimes they refer to him as an angel, the angel of God. And these were three angels. But they were coming down to judge Sodom and Gomorrah. And on the way, they stopped and talked to Abraham at his tent. Abraham insisted on having them to dinner. I love the way they had people at dinner in those days. Just a sec, we'll go kill a goat. They must have sat there for hours, you know. Get some wheat, grind it up, make it into bread, you know. So they sat there for hours talking, and part of the discussion was God. Whether Abraham really recognized who it was or not isn't made totally clear, but he says, you are going to have a son. So that message must have been familiar. And he goes, but I'm 99, Sarah's 90, how's that even possible? Now, this is where the mother comes in. She's in the tent listening, and she laughs. She goes, yeah, right, you know. And God hears her, says, Sarai, I know you're in there, and you laughed. And she goes, no, I didn't. You know, she should have had a clue when he couldn't even see her and he knew her name and everything, that she was dealing with somebody special. So she, not only did she laugh at God, she lied to him about laughing about it. Then another really interesting thing. So what you can see is Sarai's not exactly perfect, right? She's already jumped the gun on God's plan by deciding, well, we'll have Hagar get pregnant. It was her idea. And then she gets frustrated with Hagar and kicks her out while she's pregnant. And then God comes back and reminds her that you really are going to be the mother of nations. Oh, by the way, that's when he changed her name. He changed her name from Sarai, which means princess, to Sarah, which means mother of nations. And, you know, I often wish that I could read Hebrew when I'm reading the Bible, because an awful lot of the names, that's the way it goes. Abram to Abraham was a similar kind of change. But for her, it went from princess to mother of nations. So it was significant that he changed her name. Well, don't forget that baby Ishmael had been born, because Hagar did come back when she was pregnant and gotten kicked out. And by the time Isaac is born, which is the baby of promise, he's 13 years old. Because now 25 years has gone by. And they waited about 10 years, and then they went ahead and tried to deal with Ishmael. And then they went on to have Isaac the way God planned. And now 25 years have gone by, and Ishmael's a 13-year-old. Can you imagine a 13-year-old? And he's got this brother who's the whole brother, not the half. I mean, he's the complete biological son of Abram and Sarah. And he's not like this compromised guy. Not only that, he's 13 and he's a smart aleck. So, I mean, he's mocking Isaac. And you can only imagine, there's this baby, you finally got around to having a baby. You know, I don't know what a 13-year-old would say these days. I know what I would have said when I was 13. And it would have been a lot of ugly stuff, you know, especially about this kid that belongs to this other woman. And what does Sarah do? She goes, look, I can't stand this. I can't have her making fun of my son. Don't forget, she's the one. I can't have him, Ishmael. She's the one that wanted Ishmael to be born. She kicks Sarah kicks Hagar and Ishmael out. And not only do they kick them out, here, Abraham's this rich guy. I mean, rich, rich. Big retinue of servants, lots of tents, lots of cattle, blah, blah, blah. And he gives her a water skin and says, go. And she walks out into the desert. Now, God did reassure him that everything was going to be okay. He didn't want to do it. It hurt. It actually says it hurt him because Ishmael was his son, and it really hurt him to send him away. But nonetheless, he did it. He did do it. And Sarai's like, you know, good. Out of here. And then, interestingly enough, Ishmael became the father of the Arabs. Now, you can get into a lot of trouble with all this trying to determine which old words referred to which exact areas back in those days and so on. But it's pretty clear that Ishmael was the forefather of what became all the Arabs. And later, like 2,500 years later, they became Muslim. So he wasn't the father of the Muslims necessarily, although it turned out that way. So almost all of the Arabs became Muslim. Not all, but almost all. So interestingly enough, this early divide caused by Sarai, instead of Ishmael being raised in a godly home, he gets kicked out and he winds up being the father of also a father of nations, but it's the exact nation that's been plaguing Israel ever since. So this all, I mean, it's incredible. Her poor judgment resulted in a 4,000-year war. And, according to prophecy, the end of times, you know, will come out in that area somehow. And I don't know if it's next week or 1,000 years from now, but it doesn't matter. 1,000 years is like a day to God, and a day is like 1,000 years. These are real things, real people, things that happen that are still unfolding today, okay? You know, an interesting side note is Ishmael, like I said, father of the Arabs, his grandsons, Ishmaelites, are the ones who buy Joseph as a slave from Joseph's brothers. So they're the grandsons of Ishmael. The grandsons of Isaac sell their brother to the grandsons of Ishmael as a slave. How weird is that? And then they take him down and sell him as a slave in Egypt because they're just slave traders. They don't keep them. They just buy them, buy and sell. They're traders, you know. So, man, so much depth in here. So much amazing stuff going on. Sarah dies when she's 127 years old. Like I said, they tended to live a long time in those days. Not as long as Methuselah at 989 or whatever it was. The ages were coming down more to like what they are nowadays. But she died at 127. Isaac's still not married. I did the math. That means he was about 36. He's about 36 years old. I was thinking of that movie, The 40-Year-Old Virgin, you know, which was, I didn't see it. I don't think you should either, but I'm not your judge. So. But anyway, it's just like he's 36 years old. In those days, guys got married young, you know. I mean, even if they knew they were going to live to be 100 years, they wanted to have sex, and you couldn't have sex until you got married, you know. And really the mom was often the one that would kind of like arrange things. So the picture that I get is that Sarah, she was just like glommed onto this guy, and she didn't want to share him with anybody, you know. And there's a lot of, you can see some of the ways she treats him and so on. It's kind of, he's mama's boy, right? Mama dies, and Papa says, Abraham says, got to find a wife for this boy, especially now that his mom's gone. And so they send down to some relatives, and he winds up getting Rebecca as a wife. Rebecca was not a perfect mother either, and I was going to do about all the mothers, and then I realized this thing would get way too long. So you find out that Rebecca had favoritism between her two sons, Isaac, and Rebecca had Jacob and Esau. She liked Jacob, and Isaac liked Esau. So as parents, they were playing favorites. Jacob has 12 sons, like I said, and by four women, two of which are his wives and two of which are servants. And of those 12, he really likes Joseph, the youngest at the time, and he treats him real special, and that's why the other guys get so ticked off, they sell him into slavery. So, and in fact, both Jacob and, who did Jacob marry? I forgot. Isaac and Rebecca. Rachel, there were four, that's why I forgot. But anyway, Rachel was his favorite wife, and Joseph was the first son of that favorite wife, so that's why he was his favorite. But they both treated him special. They gave him special little clothes, and even though he's the youngest, you know, he kind of went around. I told his brothers he'd be the head of everybody someday. And they didn't like that. So every mother down the line of the Jewish nation, which was responsible for ultimately being the lineage that led to the birth of Jesus Christ, the Savior of us all, they were all screwing up, all down the line. And unless you guys start getting too smug, all the dads were screwing up, all down the line. You know, in every way imaginable, they were messing up. Either they were going along with what their wife said, or they weren't going along with what their wife said. They were playing favorites. They did things like pretend their wives weren't their wives, but were their sisters. Both Isaac and Abraham did that. I mean, they just messed up all over the place. So, naturally, you figure if you go to the New Testament, God would use them as examples of real screw-ups, right? Wrong. In fact, if you go into Galatians, again, it's towards the end of Galatians, chapters 4 and 5, and I forget which one, but Paul, the Apostle Paul, who wrote Galatians, I'm speaking figuratively. He says, Hagar stands for the Mount Sinai, which was Arabia. And Sarah was a free woman. Hagar stands for slavery, and Sarah stands for freedom. And I'm reading that thinking, man, Paul wrote a lot of stuff that is hard to understand, but I'm thinking, what has she got to do with the mountain? Well, where did God hand down the Ten Commandments? Mount Sinai. And under the first covenant, how did it basically work? You do what God says, or you get zapped, right? You do what God says, or you get cursed. You do what he says, you get blessed. You don't do what he says, you get cursed. You're a slave under the law. Hagar, and it's interesting to me that the Muslims basically are the most legalistic that I know of. There's some Christian cults that are similar, okay, but extremely, so-called Christian cults, extremely legalistic. And it is the slavery to the law. You do it this, that's why this whole thing about Sharia law is such a big deal, because you do it this way, we chop your hand off, we stone you to death, we kill you. You know, it's very harsh. And that's what Hagar stands for. Sarah is a free woman. She's the mother of promise, bears the son of promise. In other words, in faith, in this miraculous intervention, she gives birth to a son who then goes on to lead a nation who, although they receive the law, it says in the Bible that that was to teach them that they weren't going to be able to get to God that way. You know, God gave them the law and said, here, try to follow this. And it was like, go ahead, right? What's that? Here's the rule book. Just play by and everything will be cool. And they couldn't do it. They could not do it. God still loved them anyway, but they couldn't do it. And then in the second covenant, God says, okay, now that we proved that you cannot do it that way, we're going to make a new way, and that is God will become a man, and he'll be a perfect man. He's going to be the one guy who's not a screw-up, right? The one guy who does it all perfect. And because you all love him so much for doing that, you will stone him, you'll whip him, beat him, spit on him, and nail him to a cross. I always remember that. People say to me, I don't understand why so-and-so is not being nice to me. I've been really nice to them. You know, duh. You can be perfect to some people. You can be perfect to most people, and they're still going to do nasty stuff to you, right? If you're married, you know that. The women know that. The women know that, right? The men, not so much. Dangerous ground. No, but if you have a friend, a close friend, you see, this thing about Mother's Day, sure, we want to remember the good things, but we want to remember they're human beings too. We want to remember that they need forgiveness just as much as we do. And that goes for fathers. My relationship with my mother was pretty good. As they say nowadays, my father, not so much. And he had many fine qualities, but the ones that weren't so fine really banged up against the qualities of mine that weren't so fine and created a lot of friction and a lot of, it's affected me my whole life. Here I am, almost 65 years old, and I still can feel things in me that are the result of that interaction that happened 50 years ago, you know, or more, 50, 60 years ago. We're born in sin, all of us. So what do we expect from our mothers, our fathers, our brothers, our sisters? Well, what we can expect from them is good and bad. And if they are in Christ, we can expect that they will be made new. But if you think it's going to happen like that, you're going to be sadly disappointed for yourself or for them. Doesn't happen that way. It's a process. It's a process of getting rid of the sin nature, learning to live by the Spirit in obedience. It's a process. It's not an event. Getting saved, you know, we could stand here and argue, what's that word, you know, semantics all day long. But getting saved is very important. That turning point where you go to God and say, I'm ready. I accept you. I believe in you, and I believe that you died for me, and I believe it. That's very important. But it's the beginning. It's not the start and the finish, okay? And it's true. Now, this is where it gets a little tough for me. My mother never professed the Lord. I never went to church once as a child, not once. My father had a major chip on his shoulder about the church. And the one time he, I don't know who was sitting next to him, but we had an outdoor service here, and he came while my kids were still young. No, well, they were teenagers. And he sat next to me, and as the service progressed, he started cursing. God damn it, God, what the hell are you? You know, I'm trying to mutter on purpose a little bit. But and he came over and he sat right there on the porch. It was an outdoor service, and he smoked cigarettes, and I could just see him over there just cursing and muttering the whole time. And he died, as far as I know, never confessing the Lord. My mother was much, much milder about the whole thing, but we never talked about God once in my life. that I knew them. When I tried, I got shut down. Later on, when I became a Christian and they were still alive, I'd only been a Christian for a few years, and I would try, and they would just shut it right down. Boom. We're not talking about that. So it's pretty hard for me to say that we're made new in Christ, because I don't know if they ever were. Okay? And one of the things Barbara's mother used to say to me is, she says, I don't know how I can go to, she's dead now. She died a few years ago. But she said, I don't know how I can go to heaven and if my children aren't all come to know the Lord, how could I ever be happy in heaven if they weren't there? Right? And I had been studying a lot and everything, and so I said to her, I don't know. Because I'd studied enough to know I don't know. I read the whole Bible a bunch of times, and there's no answer for that. That's a tough thing, and that's true for the people that you love right now, whether they're your mother or your friend or whatever. We don't know. And I don't know. People say, well, maybe they received the Lord, you know, in their last gasping breath or something like that. Maybe so. Maybe they had loved the Lord since they were 12 and they were just putting on a show. Who knows? God knows. I don't know. All I know is we never talked about it, we never went to church, and they never said anything to me at all about professing the Lord. But assuming that we do accept the Lord the way I was talking about, we go through this process, and even if our mothers or father or friend or brother, sister, fellow congregant, even if they have accepted the Lord, for you to expect them to act perfect all the time is pretty darn stupid, right? I mean, that would be like expecting you to act perfect all the time. And the Bible, that's why the Bible says, as you judge, that's how you're going to be judged back. Don't do it. You don't want to get it back the way you hand it out. Now, unfortunately, I know we all do it. I know I do. And if there's one of you that doesn't do it in here, I want you to preach next week and explain exactly how you manage that. And we'll all stand back and wait for the lightning bolt to hit, you know. Do we expect our mothers to live according to the law? Do we expect ourselves to live according to the law? If you can forgive your mother or your father or your brother for not living according to the law, maybe you can forgive yourself or understand, not forgive yourself really, that's not so important. It's maybe you can understand that God forgives you for not living according to the law and messing up. It just blows my mind when people, I've been in this fellowship for 30 years, and new people will come and they'll say, oh, you and Barbara, you know, you're examples of people who just live this Christian life. And then, and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, if you had any idea, you know, of what we've done, what we still do. But, you know, I give God credit for changing me a lot. But I am not going to stand up here and tell you that God changed me to the point that now I get to be a great example for them. Paul said, follow me as I follow Christ. And I used to think, wow, he could, yeah, but he didn't say follow me when I don't follow Christ, right? So I'll say the same thing to you. Follow me when I follow Christ. Don't follow me the rest of the time. It's not going to be good. Love your mother. Love your father. Love your sister, love your brother, love your friend, love your enemy, is what Jesus says. Boy, that's a hard one. Love the ISIS guys who set the guy on fire. Love the sex offender. Love the murderer. Okay? We're supposed to love everybody. No excuse, no exceptions. He tells us to forgive others as he forgive us. And so love them and remember that they're human. Remember that they still have, they're in a process just like you are, and they will do bad things. End of sermon. Thank you. They don't know. You're dismissed.